once the shopping malls are gleaming, and no one needs to know how many babies' bodies are in this soil that we've tilled. Once the last Palestinians killed. Once the last Palestinians killed. Once the last Palestinians killed.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, Israel's martial bellicosity is no revelation to its neighbors, all of whom have been attacked or experience still regular bombing by its air force, assassinations, and acts of either direct or sponsored terrorism, none arguably more so than Lebanon. As Gaza burns and the West Bank and East Jerusalem are assailed by settler fanatics and their government allies, a broader war between Israel and Lebanon smolders. Dimitri Lascaris is an activist, journalist, and lawyer. Dimitri, too, served as justice critic for both the Quebec Provincial Greens and the Green Party of Canada, narrowly missing leadership of the latter in 2020. He's been traveling extensively in and reporting from West Asia for several months now, most recently in Lebanon. His video reports and articles from the Middle East are available at his site, DimitriLascaris.org, where I found his recent piece, Israel's War Against Nature. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me again.
Well, it's always my pleasure. Of course, now, before getting to your article, I watched you and Laith Maruth on his Wartime Cafe program from Beirut, where you mentioned having come through some dicey situations together. What, Dimitri, did you and Laith encounter in your travels in the south of Lebanon?
Well, we were in the two parts of South Lebanon where there has been fairly regular aerial combat. They haven't engaged the ground forces each other, but there's daily exchange of fire across the border. And the two areas where the vast majority of the combat has occurred are South Lebanon, south of the Litani River, and the Bekaa Valley, which is near the borders on Syria and is near the Golan Heights. So we visited those two areas. We stayed, we didn't stay overnight in the Bekaa Valley. We spent a day in the Bekaa Valley. And we went to the areas where Hezbollah was founded and where it continues to have, probably continues to have, we didn't see them, but, you know, military installations. And certainly there's a tremendous amount of support for Hezbollah in this area. And then we went into South Lebanon, and we stayed actually in a house for two nights that was within sight of an Israeli military base called Al Manara, so we could see it from the backyard. And there were fairly regular explosions. One landed quite close to our house. I actually had my camera out and was just letting it run and recorded that explosion. Laith was in the living room doing an interview on the Garland Nixon show when that airstrike occurred.
And I was watching that program actually, and I saw he just about jumped out of his shoes.
Yes, and yeah, I watched the replay of it, and you know, it sounds, as Garland reacts when he hears the noise, and he says it sounds like a gunshot. I can assure you it sounded like a lot more than that. It was really a shock to the system, and my ears were ringing for a few hours after that. I was sitting outside at a picnic table when it struck.
Well, I could hear the jet overhead, yeah, as well.
And the bizarre thing was, you know, we could hear jets and drones. We couldn't see them because it was cloudy, and they were probably flying above the clouds. But we could hear them for a few hours, and then suddenly everything went silent. While I was sitting at this picnic table and Laith is talking to Garland Nixon in the living room. And after 2 minutes of silence, you know, this deafening explosion happened. And I asked, there was a Lebanese journalist named Hadi Hotait who was traveling with us. I asked him about that. He said, yes, this is a common practice of the Israeli pilots. They basically turn off their engines and glide for a couple of minutes before the bomb strikes. I don't know whether they do that to help them to avoid detection or whether, you know, it's meant to terrify people even more. But fortunately, that particular strike didn't injure anybody. And then probably the most remarkable thing of all was that on my final visit to South Lebanon, so we left that house because we were not feeling particularly safe. It was interesting because I was told, I learned a lot about staying alive in these circumstances from Hadi, this Lebanese journalist. You know, at one point I pulled out my binoculars and my intention was to try to get a better view of the Israeli military base. And he said, never point a lens in the direction of Israel. And I said, why? He said, because they have this infrared, these infrared beams, these devices, which are constantly sweeping the border area in South Lebanon. And these things can pick up when a lens is looking at them. And they then engage in some kind of analysis, and they think if it might be a Hezbollah fighter who's, you know, engaged in surveillance of their military operations, they'll strike him with a drone or, possibly an airstrike. So I actually never pointed a lens the entire 48 hours that we were there in the direction of Israel, because Hadi told me to avoid doing that. In any event, when we were just about to leave South Lebanon, after staying for two nights in that house, we went to a place called Beaufort Castle. And from Beaufort Castle, we could see another Israeli military base called Metula, which is a few kilometers away. And that's where I did the report that you mentioned, Israel's War Against Nature. I was standing atop Beaufort Castle. And after I finished the report and we started walking down, Hezbollah launched an attack on the Metula air military base. And it went on for, I think, 4 or 5 minutes. And there was one particularly huge explosion. You could see this ball of flame go up when it struck the military base. And several seconds later, with this deafening noise, it took some time to travel across the valley and arrive at us, but there was a deafening noise. And Hadi told us that looked to him like a thermobaric weapon, which was designed to inflict maximum casualties on the military personnel in what is surely a heavily fortified base. So it is very hot down there. It is extremely difficult to get access. And based on what I've been reading, Chris, for the last few days, things have gotten particularly more intense in terms of the combat since I left.
Well, now that interview with Laith at Wartime Cafe, you can get it on Rumble and do a search for Free Palestine TV. Well, about your article now, Israel's War Against Nature, we've seen reports here at CBC and so forth over the last, I guess, a week or so, maybe a little bit more than that, about brush fires or forest fires in northern Israel. Not mentioned, that I've seen at least, are the fires that the Israeli military has been setting for many weeks now, months even, with the use of white phosphorus in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I was, I didn't actually see the use of white phosphorus myself, but one of the things we did when we were in South Lebanon was I interviewed the director of civil defense for the entire area of South Lebanon, so everything south of the Litani River. And I haven't yet published that interview because we need to get it translated, but he told me in the interview that the Israeli military had been using white phosphorus systematically to set ablaze to the forest because Hezbollah's fighters need to use, forest in order to protect themselves from Israeli drones and airstrikes. If they just go out into the open, they'd be quickly annihilated. And so I had seen virtually no reporting on this. And 3 days after I published my report on Israel's War Against Nature, where I talked about this, Human Rights Watch put out a report in which it said that Israel had documented Israel's use of white phosphorus in, I think, 12 municipalities in Lebanon. And there have been fires raging there for months. And, I think what happened in Israel, I'm not even sure if it was intentional, but if it was intentional that Hezbollah set this area alight, it was a result of a decision made, I think, on their part to retaliate for all the fires that have been set in South Lebanon. And as you've indicated, predictably, Chris, the Western press ignore what happens in South Lebanon almost entirely and only talk about what the Israeli population is suffering in northern Israel. And they never, they, not only do they not talk about, you know, the damage Israel is doing to the natural environment in South Lebanon, which is immense, but in addition, they don't talk about the military casualties that Hezbollah is inflicting. Every day, Hezbollah puts out detailed reports, which are usually accompanied by videos. It's quite remarkable, actually, because they show you, they show you in these videos the firing of the missile or the drone, and then you can follow the trajectory of the missile or the drone during the video, and they will show you the military target, and usually you'll be able to see the impact. The only time you can't see the impact is when it's a suicide drone, and you'll see the footage, you'll see the video right up to the moment of impact. And then afterwards, the drone is destroyed, and so is the camera. So you don't see that. But these are very well-documented attacks that are occurring multiple times a day on military targets across northern Israel. And the media is saying virtually nothing about this. But the fact of the matter is that this is catastrophic for Israel. Israel does not have the capacity, despite, you know, its vaunted air defense systems. We hear constantly about the Iron Dome. It does not have the capacity to stop many of the missiles that are attacking, that Hezbollah is using. And oftentimes these missiles will strike without even the air defense sirens going off. There's absolutely no warning whatsoever. Not only do they fail to, you know, knock down the missile or the drone, but they don't even have a moment to prepare for the impact. And so this is going to have massive strategic implications for Israel in the years ahead. It's amazing to me that the media is saying nothing about this, because it's a very, very important part of the story.
Well, they're not, there's a lot not being said in the media in this country, and you, I don't need to tell you about that. Well, Human Rights Watch, as you mentioned, they cite widespread, they say, use of white phosphorus across 17 municipalities in Lebanon, five of which are populated, and using these kinds of ordnance in populated areas is a war crime. You talk about in your article, and again, it's Israel's war against nature. You talk about an organization, and this is the really sad part about it, where it looks like fighting fire with fire, and meanwhile we all burn. But you talk about this organization, Green Without Borders, and the work they've done over many years now to reforest southern Lebanon, and they being declared a terrorist organization.
Yeah, and it was an organization that was founded in 2013. Its stated mission is to reforest South Lebanon, and that's exactly what they've done. And when I was standing atop Beaufort Castle, I was looking down on a plain known as Arnun, and you could see their plantations. You know, these trees that are nice, lined up, you know, planted in an orderly manner. Some of them were very young saplings. Some of them were not mature trees, but they were taller than a human being, at least. And you know, South Lebanon has been largely deforested over the years, partly because of warfare. And, you know, it very much needs to be reforested. This is not just a question of creating a more aesthetically pleasing natural environment. Forests, you know, they absorb carbon dioxide, so it helps us to deal with a climate crisis that is spiraling out of control. They help to prevent erosion, which is a problem. They also provide shade in what is becoming a very, very arid and hot environment, particularly in the summertime. You know, I spend a lot of time now in the southern coast of Greece, where I have a second home. That's where I am now. It's, I think, 38 degrees right now outside, and it's mid-June. So when you live in that kind, and, you know, Lebanon is further south than the southern tip of Greece. So when you live in that kind of an environment, it's very important to have, you know, forests. And because the Biden administration, at the insistence of Israel, designated this organization as a terrorist organization on the theory that it was its trees were providing cover to Hezbollah fighters, it's now in a much more difficult position in terms of actually achieving its mandate. So, for example, you know, who's going to be able to donate money to this organization from outside of Lebanon? Excuse me, from outside of Lebanon, especially from a Western country. You'd be running afoul of U.S. sanctions if you did that. So this really constrains their fundraising ability.
Well, this reveals that Israel's motive in burning these forests is a literal scorched earth policy to provide a visual buffer zone between them and Lebanon. Is that a crime internationally, a crime against nature, or how does that fall to burn forests in this manner in a neighboring country?
There is developing law around the notion of ecocide, I think the law is in a state of flux, but one certainly could make the case that this constitutes a crime against humanity. It certainly does. A lot of this land that is being set alight is agricultural land. There's a purely civilian purpose. I mean, some of the stuff that's going up in flames are not trees. Some of it is just agricultural land that, some of it, olive trees, for example, or some of the trees that have been damaged. But then you have crops, not forests, that are going up in flames. Certainly, intentionally or recklessly setting alight to agricultural land is a war crime, no question about it. But when it begins to have a devastating impact overall on the environment, and it's being done for no purpose other than to cause suffering to the civilian population, it's more than a war crime and arguably rises to the level of a crime against humanity.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri's an activist, journalist, and lawyer. He is too served in the past as justice critic for both the Quebec and provincial Greens and the Green Party of Canada, and almost took the leadership there. How much different things would be, I wonder, Dimitri, had that been a square vote with the Green Party way back when? But he has now found himself in Greece, as he says, reporting from Dimitri. Lascaris.org, especially these last months, these very dramatic months in the region. You're on your website, Dimitri. I was looking at another article from Jenine refugee camp. Rahab Nazal reveals the extent of Israel's destruction. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who Rahab is?
Sure. Rahab is a very talented artist and documentary filmmaker. She pursued her graduate studies at the University of Western Ontario. She's done a number of exhibitions in Canada over the years. The focus of her work is the Palestinian struggle for freedom. She is a Canadian citizen, not only a Palestinian, but nowadays spends most of her time in a community near Bethlehem, and she lectures at a university in the occupied West Bank. Rahab was shot by an Israeli sniper. I believe it was 2017. I could have that wrong, but
15.
Thanks for reminding me. And she was simply in Bethlehem at the time, photographing as part of her work the activities of what Palestinians call a skunk truck. This is a truck that spews extremely noxious fluids onto people in their homes. And in this particular case, that's what it was doing. It was spewing noxious fluids onto homes of Palestinians in Bethlehem. And, this is for no purpose other than to make life miserable for Palestinians living under occupation. And there's no military purpose whatsoever to doing that sort of thing. And as she was filming it peacefully, she was shot in the leg by an Israeli sniper. And she happened to get a photograph of the sniper immediately prior to the shot being fired. Palestinian ambulance tried to approach her, the Israeli military started raining tear gas down on the truck. And there are photographs of this, which I obtained, which show Rahab lying in the street. And there's an ambulance parked nearby with Arabic writing on it. And you can see tear gas smoke enveloping the ambulance. So this was all documented. And Rahab asked me, said to Rahab, you shouldn't simply let this go. She's a friend of mine. You should demand that the Canadian government take this up with the Israeli government and ensure accountability for the soldiers who did this. And so she agreed that I could represent her. I did that on a pro bono basis. And for 2 years, Chris, I wrote letters to Chrystia Freeland, who at the time was the foreign minister. I wrote letters to Deborah Lyons, who at the time was the ambassador of Canada to Israel, is now the special envoy of Trudeau. for anti-Semitism. And by the way, Miss Lyons, just so you know where her sympathies lie, you know, in the last 48 hours or so, after Israel massacred, you know, 270 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in order to recover four hostages, she was commending Israel, and without even expressing a hint of sorrow at the loss of 274, I believe it was, Palestinian lives, plus hundreds more were wounded in this vicious attack. It was the worst atrocity in terms of the casualties during the entire genocide that started in October of last year. And this person, who was at the time Canada's ambassador to Israel, was publicly celebrating what happened. So as you can imagine, Ms. Lyons did absolutely nothing when she was the ambassador of Canada to Israel to vindicate the rights of Rahab Nazal. Chrystia Freeland did absolutely nothing. I also wrote to the representative of Canada in Ramallah, in the occupied West Bank. He too did absolutely nothing. And after years of trying, and I was met, Chris, with total silence. They wouldn't even acknowledge my letters. I did a Freedom of Information request just to find out what was going on, and they were discussing my letters internally. I got heavily redacted documents back from the Canadian government, which showed that they were aware, and these were being discussed at a high level within the Global Affairs Canada, and they simply made a decision, for reasons that we've never been told, to ignore us, completely ignore us. So that's what we're dealing with here, the Canadian government, and we're talking here about a government that is, you know, a minority Liberal government propped up by the NDP. One would think that if a government in Canada was ever going to be somewhat sympathetic towards the Palestinian cause, it would be a minority Liberal government propped up by the NDP. But they have continued to show right up until the current day complete and utter contempt for the lives of the Palestinian people.
Well, and your discussion with Rahab was, you did a recent talk with her, and she, as she was walking around in Jenin, that's in the West Bank, that has been under a sale. Do you want to talk about that
sure.
discussion and what you saw?
Well, I was actually in the West Bank in March of this year, and Rahab took me to the Jenin refugee camp and a couple of other camps. We spent 2 days in that camp, and we saw a number of civilian buildings which had been destroyed, including a daycare center, utterly demolished by airstrikes. We saw that the roads had been carved up by military bulldozers. We spoke to people who had been detained, abused by Israeli military forces. This is all since October of last year. And when I spoke to Rahab, I recognized the places she was in when she was walking there, because I was only, you know, it was only 3 or 4 months ago that I was actually in that camp. And I could see myself from the images that things are much worse now. Israel has escalated its destruction of the civilian infrastructure. Rahab was there the day after Israel launched its largest military operation in the Jenin refugee camp since October of last year. And they killed 12 residents of the camp in one assault. This is also, by the way, the camp where the American Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was murdered by an Israeli sniper last year, or it might have been 2022. And there's a shrine to Shireen, who was much loved amongst the Palestinian people, in Jenin. And when I was there in March, they destroyed it. The Israelis had destroyed the shrine to Jenin to Shireen Abu Akleh. It's just the most remarkable thing. That the Israeli military consistently behaves in this manner and is allowed by Western governments to get away with it. So the only thing I want to say about this, because it was quite ominous, but Rahab reported when I was speaking to her, you know, a couple of days ago while she was in the camp, that the lunatic finance minister of Israel, Smotrich, had appeared just outside the camp a few days earlier and had said publicly, in front of Israeli media, that they were going to reduce the Jenin refugee camp to Gaza. In other words, they were going to obliterate it. I don't think anybody should have any illusions about the willingness of the Israeli government and military to do just that.
Yeah, well, she says in that interview that all all of the camps are targeted, not just Jenin, although Jenin is especially focused on and known as the martyrs' capital because of its long resistance to the occupation. And Smotrich says, quote, "We will turn the West Bank into Gaza." Obviously, an ominous thing to be said. I looked a little further in, because I was so interested in her, to some of her other work. She did an interview with Press TV, the Iranian press, just a few months ago in January, and the stark comparison of her appearance was a little bit shocking to me, just to see. She looked pretty rough. I don't know if that's something that she's going through or if that's an indication of the more general situation in the area. Do you know?
Well, I visited her home, you know, briefly. We met there and before getting in a taxi to go to the to Jenin. And she seems to be living in, you know, fairly, relatively speaking, a fairly safe accommodation. But I think probably what you're seeing is the impacts of the psychological impacts of what Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza are enduring. It is absolutely, I don't know how the people living under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza maintain their will to live, frankly. It's so devastating what they experience on a daily basis, and to see the Western governments refuse to do anything to stop this is terrible. It takes a terrible toll on the, I think, their spirit and their psychology, but they've amazingly managed to maintain their will to prevail.
Well, and when you talk about Shireen Abu Akleh, the journalist, she was an American Palestinian. And when you say that the Canadian government did nothing to assist in Rahab Nazal's case, the Americans likewise did nothing in the Shireen Abu Akleh case, where she was blatantly targeted and murdered by an Israeli soldier. Denied, of course, at first, and then finally, despite ample and obvious evidence of that, and Rahab Nazal, as well as being an artist and doing this journalistic work as a documentary filmmaker, in looking at her interview with Press TV, she talks about her documentary Vibrations from Gaza, about the school for the deaf in Gaza that was recently destroyed by the military there. At Faluna Society for Deaf Children, and just a few weeks ago, its director and his entire family being targeted, well, being blown up, whether they were targeted or not, he being killed, Hashem Ghazal and his wife both being killed, and their seven children severely wounded. When you talk about this war against nature, there's also a war against learning and against schooling. Scholasticide is the new term that is being coined now for that. We're moving into a area where we're creating, the dictionary is being affected by what Israel is doing now, creating new words for new and old atrocities. Dmitry, we just have like a minute left. Do you want to finish with your thoughts in 1 minute?
Sure. As devastating as all of this is, and you know, there's no end in sight. I do believe, and I'll say this as often as I can, that Israel is being defeated. The Palestinian people are prevailing, and really, the only question here is how much blood is the West going to allow the Israelis to continue to spill before they finally accept that the apartheid regime has come to an end, and it will not survive this. It will not. That's the question. And I'm not hopeful that the governments of the West ultimately will develop a conscience about all of this, but that ultimately is going to have devastating impacts for Israelis as well.
Well, the political effects are being felt around the world, and who knows how far that will go. Find out more about what Dmitry's doing by going to his website, dmitrylascaris.org. Thanks a lot for coming on again, Dmitry.
Thank you very much, Chris. Good talking to you.
And I'd like to thank Dan Kovalik as well. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time. Good, bad, and ugly news on Guerrilla Radio at guerrilla-radio.com. That's Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every week.